Hi, everyone. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you is The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests help you lead a more positively minded life. And I tell you something, friends. I tell you, we have such a series of knowledge, information coming our way over the next few days. Thanks to the presence here of Roberta Maria Atti, and tomorrow Neil Schachter from Mount Sinai Hospital is going to be here. And the focus of Neil's work, a book that I read recently, has brought me to help with Roberta explore this issue of oxygen and breath. Now, we have had a number of people over the years who have told you, and they told you very well, that if you don't take care of your body with proper nutrition, if you don't oxygenate your body, then if you don't have oxygen working for you, things don't work very well. This is kind of information that everybody knows. We've had, you know, practically every physician that's ever been on air, you know, and we've had Gary Null for years was talking about proper oxygenation of the body, and Majid Ali talks about, I mean, its primary concern of what he believes is that you've got to get oxygen enough in all of your cells to get it to work, and practically every nutritionist focuses on this. So one of the ways that the oxygen gets to you is through your breathing. That's one of the ways. There are many ways. And so we want to take a look at how breathing works, number one. And you may not think that this has any importance, because you could say, I know how breathing works. You breathe in, you breathe out. That's one. And we're not going to do anything simple like teach you how to breathe. None of that. That's too easy to learn. What we're going to focus on today is the role of breathing and emotions. It's a funny thing. There is such a strong connection between the emotions you feel and the breathing you do and the way you breathe. That somewhere early on, you learn to use your breathing to control your emotions. Of course you do.
Well, in fact, Armand, if you look at a baby, you will see a human being who knows how to breathe. We are born knowing how to breathe fully from the abdomen all the way up in a relaxed way. And when the baby cries and screams, still the baby knows how to breathe. But then as we grow up, what happens is that every time we have to suppress an emotion or a feeling for whatever reason, the way we do it is through controlling the breath, meaning we constrict the lungs, we constrict the space within the chest, we contract the diaphragm and a bunch of other muscles, and we stop, in effect, we stop the current, the emotional wave that goes through us by controlling the breathing.
Now, you know, you said interesting thing. You said current. You control the oxygen going to the nervous system, therefore cutting down, desensitizing. That's one, I imagine, right?
Right.
You control the flow of your breathing. If you contract your stomach muscles, you know.
Well, if you notice, any time you get upset, any time anything upsets you, even a little bit, if you remember the next time you get upset about anything, check your breathing. You will notice that it has gotten shallower. And this is how we control our, let's say, explosiveness of emotions. And to some extent, that's understandable and acceptable. Because
sure.
If we didn't do that, we would be exploding all over the place with all kinds of emotions. So we have to learn to contain it. However, when we suppress our emotions and feelings chronically, every day, all the time, what happens is the breathing becomes more shallow on a permanent basis, and then, you know, other things happen.
And that may be the best thing you could do.
And that may be the best thing you can do, exactly.
So, you know, if you're a kid and you live in a house and you cry, and you start to cry, and it happens to be an inconvenience to the people in charge because they can't handle you and the 15 other kids who are in your family if one of you is crying, so they may yell across to you, stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. I'll drown your doll or I'll do something, you know, to give you or I'll punish you. Well, you know, you're crying and you hear the threat. What do? You take a gulp of air and you shut off your breathing. You stop breathing.
Yeah, you literally can pull back your tears by inhaling deeply enough that you throw it all back down where it came from. All of that emotional energy that's coming up, you can just go, and you just gulp it down, and the tears stop, literally. They stop flowing, and so does the emotion. And all of a sudden, you feel like you are calmer, but it's a little bit of a deceitful, it's a little bit of a deception, because, yes, in that moment, you may be feel more in control, but where did that emotion go?
Also, what you might do is tense your body.
Exactly.
Now, of course, tensing your body does the very same thing. It controls your lungs, it controls your heart, it controls your shoulders, your muscles. By tensing your body, you can, by tightening your jaw, you can control your emotion, but all of that has a direct effect on the oxygenation of your body and the oxygenation of your emotions. Your emotions, in order to be felt completely, seem to need an open channel of air. The less air you give it, the less oxygen you give it, the less you feel. You know, how often do you see people as they get older, they start losing less and less, they start getting less and less sensation in their genitals? A lot of people talk about that. They talk about how they go sexually dead over time. And those very same people will be seen to be people who control a lot of their emotions by inhibiting their breathing. So you could just imagine, they're cutting off the sensation to their bodies, you know, they're tightening their diaphragm, tightening the oxygen flow, and with less oxygen flow, you feel less sexually. Men who have smoked cigarettes over the years have been known, you know, it's one of the common things of men who are smokers lose sensations in their penis.
Well, Armand, you're saying something important. It's not just the negative emotions that we can withhold and control by tightening up the breath. It's also the positive emotions like love. And, you know, when children are spontaneously loving, let's say, and something goes wrong so that their ability to love gets, you know, impaired by circumstances. The next time they want to love someone, there is a fear now that something bad is going to happen. So there's an automatic constriction of the breathing to prevent that love from flowing, the experience of it.
The mechanism, and let me give you an example of it. Let's say you have a puppy. Let's say you have a dog like a Japanese... A Japanese chin.
Mm-hmm.
Look up Japanese chin, my friends. Look at the face on that animal. Let's say you have a beautiful dog and you have a beautiful puppy. And you love your dog. And you love it, love it, love it. And for some reason, your mother, your father says, we got to get rid of the dog.
Mm.
And when parents do that, they very often, they may be for good reasons.
Sure.
You know, the dog...
But it happens.
The dog may have leprosy or something. And
oh, Armand, I'll never forget. That's what happened with Sydney. When I got Sydney, he belonged to a family where the father had gone to jail and the mother had to get rid of the dog. And Sydney was huge, as you know, so she couldn't take care of him. And
people
this
should know
boy,
Sydney's a dog, by the way.
He was a dog.
Was a dog.
And the boy, when I went to pick up Sydney, who was this beautiful one-year-old Pyrenees, he belonged to a 10-year-old boy, and the boy knew that I had gone there to take his dog. Armand, I can't even talk about it without crying. Just the look on the boy's face, having to separate from Sydney, and I promised him that I would take care of Sydney, but, oh my God, I'm crying already just thinking about that boy. I kept letting him know that Sydney was doing fine, but that separation was horrendous.
You know, maybe
for me, let alone for
maybe
him.
Maybe time for you to get in touch with him.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? Just tell him about history saga.
By now, he's going to be a 25-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Yes, I should. I will.
Nice thing, But let's say you're a child and you have this wonderful dog and the dog dies or that has to go away or something like that. Now you, if you're a child, you let yourself attach at levels that you can't imagine.
Right.
You love your puppy.
With your whole heart, mind, soul, everything.
And you think about it. You draw pictures about it. You keep, you know, you think about it when you're in school, your dog. You know, that's what you think about for many people. Then that very same child, after losing the dog, passes a pet shop, and they see a similar kind of puppy. At first, their heart jumps, you know. I love it, I love it. But then comes the controller. Then they hold their breath. They push it down. They shove it down, and they say, oh, I can't love it too much because I can't have it.
I can't let myself feel that. It's too painful.
And this is what each of us have done. Yeah. In our romantic relationships throughout our life.
Mm-hmm.
We loved once. The next time we loved a little less. The next time we loved a little less.
And breathed a little less.
And breathed a little less. Or we loved wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We did it one way or another. But one way or another, we guaranteed ourselves that we weren't going to go through the pain.
Mm-hmm.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about our breath and how our breath and breathing and oxygenation of our body controls our emotions.
You know, I would like to say something about breathing in relation to depression, because I think a lot of people who suffer with depression, I don't know if they are aware of it or not, but really breathe very little. Because in order to stay depressed, you need to not allow a lot of oxygen to come into your body. The moment you allow a lot of oxygen to come into your body, depression would lift, because whether you express a negative emotion or rage or whatever it is, the moment you allow oxygen to reach all your cells, those emotions are going to be felt and expressed. And the only way to keep them at bay is to not breathe.
And the best thing you could do if you're depressed is to do just what you do, breathe shallow.
Right.
Because to open up is going to lead to a kind of panic anxiety at first.
I was going to say that in fact,
we are not here saying to people, if you're depressed, breathe better.
No.
Forget it.
Often,
do what you're doing.
In fact, when people are upset, someone will stop by and say, well, take a breath, breathe deeply, and you'll feel better. No, bad advice. Sometimes when people are upset, they need to breathe in a shallow way to be able to survive the upset, to be able to go through it without anything really bad happening, because the more you breathe, the more intensely you're going to feel those emotions.
Which is why some people having panic attacks tend to hyperventilate.
Sure.
And one of the ways that they treat it is they put a paper bag over your head.
Right.
Right? And leave it there forever.
In fact,
when they have you, reverse your breathing.
When there's too much oxygen in the blood, the blood vessels will constrict, including the blood vessels to the brain, and that alone is going to cause a feeling of panic if the person is not used to it. But certainly, if I'm dealing with, let's say, tremendous grief, and I'm by myself, and this emotion is threatening to overpower me, the way I can make it through it safely is to breathe very little and kind of, you know, let it kind of slide by me. But if I breathe deeply, that grief is going to hit me like a tsunami, you know? It's basically what we're saying is that breath and emotions go hand in hand.
Yes.
The deeper you breathe, the more you feel. Infants feel everything because they breathe completely and fully. And as they grow, they learn to reduce the quantity of air they take in, and therefore they learn to control their emotional self.
But we're not saying you should go breathe better.
No, we're not saying that.
Okay, now there's a reason we're not saying that, because it would be so obvious to sit here and say, Roberta could talk to you about some of the research she's done on weight loss and breathing, on sleeping and breathing. We have so much of this stuff that we do that we don't consider the ramifications of taking one particular pathway. And for, in order for us to describe, to tell you about why we don't say, breathe deeper, breathe better, because it's, of course it's a nice idea. It's like exercise. It's a good idea. It's like shower every day. It's a good idea. But these ideas, these theories, we want to address that. Because we come from the school of no simple answer. You see, people make up theories about what you're supposed to do. Every nutritionist will make up a theory about how you've got to clean out your body and activate your this and get that working for you. And you've got to get it all working for you, and they'll tell you what nutrition to take and what pills to take and so on and so forth. Physicians will give you pills. If you have a stomach problem, give you an antacid, or will give you something to for your reflux, or will. And they'll have their theories about what could work. And everybody has a theory about what works. And did you ever notice, my friends, over the years, it's like if you ever tried to lose weight by Jenny Craig, and then you went to Weight Watchers, and then you went to a nutritionist, and then that none of the theories really worked. They were a theory for the moment. But we want to talk about why theories don't work.
Mm.
And we also want to talk about why people make up theories. And let's kind of start with why people make up theories. People make up theories to pay the rent. You see, you can't publish a book unless you have a theory.
That's right.
If people have asked me so many years, Armand, why don't you write a book about what you believe in? Because I would be writing a book about how things don't work according to theory. So I have a theory of no theories.
You would write a book about how not to write a book.
Well, it's kind of no simple answer. You know, and I know
I
you
know
think
exactly
this way,
what
Roberta.
You're saying. I know exactly
you know,
what
but
you're
what
saying.
Do you do? If you have a theory, then you can write a book.
Sure.
And then if you have a theory, you can give yourself a professional distinction. You could
say,
I'm a
theories.
Specialist.
People
they love theories.
Yeah.
Here's this person, here's a you know, go get colonics and that'll cure your life.
It's
go,
wonderful
go
because
get acupuncture.
Theories give us a sense of safety, of security, of something solid to
a
believe
discipline,
in. Yeah,
a discipline.
A structure.
I'm following it. And how many times have you counted the calories and the grams
please.
Of food and counted everything and said, here, now I'm doing it. And look, it works. It looks. I lost 4 ounces, 0.2.
97% of people who lose weight gain it back with a little bit more on top of it, more than before they dieted, 97%. And that, in my belief, is because they follow theories. Now, I don't want to disregard theories. They have a place and they have they're useful. But if we try to accomplish something pertaining to the body and the mind functioning based on a theory, in my experience and observations, theories apply for a short amount of time for some people. They're not universally applicable to everyone.
In fact, one of the things that you could find is that if you don't get stuck in one place, you could find your own combination of knowledge that comes from theoretical formulations, information that people discovered, some of it brilliant. And you look and you find it and you say, aha, we could add nutrition to self-discipline, to exercise, to something else, and you will find your own formula eventually that will give you a better directed path than just trying to follow one path. And I just want to mention that there's something I learned from Buddhism that I never forget. It's one of the rules of Buddhism is never use the development of the higher consciousness. Now, this means never use the insights that you get from really learning and getting to the point of higher consciousness to satisfy the higher chakras. Never use the wisdom from the higher chakras in service of the lower chakras. It's a rule. And it was a rule that I was taught a long time ago by a wise man. And basically what he says is the following. If you're going to have that special gift of being able to see past the ordinary into the extraordinary, don't use it for the lower chakras. And the lower chakras are sex, money, and power. So, you know, whenever you would find...
Yes, that's beautiful. Yes.
So whenever you would find a religious leader or a Buddhist or somebody wearing robes, like they would come to town and now they're going to start an ashram. The minute they start the ashram, they lose their power.
Sure.
And I've seen so many people who are so smart, who the minute they built an institute, or the minute they started training people, or the minute they started having students all over the place, you know, as soon as they started paying the rent with what they have learned.
That's so true, Armand.
They lose their power.
So true, because theories, I mean, this is my theory about theories, are not in the moment. Theories are about the past or the future. They're always about what happened or what will happen, and you take that model, the template that you've constructed in your intellect, and you've used all of your rational endowment, gray matter, human intelligence to put it together, and it looks beautiful like a diamond chiseled right there in your mind. And you take that and you apply it to reality, and reality is messy. Reality is unpredictable. Reality has 1,000 factors that you could not take into account when you chiseled your diamond. Reality is out of control. And now you're trying to control it by making it fit into a theory. It's like trying to fit the ocean into a cup. And that's why they don't work. I'm not saying not to use theories, but theories in my life support my moment, the present. They support my experience of what I'm relating to in the moment. And what Armand is saying is the brilliance of the moment can never be manipulated through a theoretical approach to health and well-being. And so it's not that it's not important to understand caloric intake and oxygen and what it does. It's just that whenever we try to control physiology through that approach, we're missing something very important.
Let me give you an example of this, okay? Because, you know, if you get it, my friends, life becomes a lot easier. Let's say, for example, you're an addict, and you're addicted to, let's say, alcohol, and alcoholism is the plague. And so suddenly you say, okay, I understand I can't drink again. I can never drink again. I will not drink. And you don't drink, and suddenly you start eating compulsively. Well, a theory would come along and it would say, ah, but the eating is better than the drinking, so let yourself get fat and then you'll go lose weight. Okay, so you go and you do that and then you go eat and you're very fat and then you go and you start smoking cigarettes to control your weight. You find it. So now we have to deal with the cigarettes. What we're saying is that it's like water. Whatever the need is, If you stop it up, it's going to come out another way. So what theoreticians do and what people do is they tell you to restrict yourself. They tell you to control yourself. They tell you to use your willpower. But wherever you're supposed to use willpower, it comes out somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is why, even in psychology, especially in psychology, there is no one school of thought that absolutely works. You must have the flexibility to be able to look at a person and see a person and study them. And you say, okay, you take away the alcohol. And then I see it comes out in food. So what are we saying? We have a theory. Oh, the sugar of the alcohol is now being converted into the sugar in food, and it's sugar you need. No, that's too simple.
Right.
Let's observe.
And see, Armand, I think the problem is that because medicine is supposed to be a science, you know, a practical science, in psychology, it's easier for people to understand that there has to be a certain amount of flexibility. But in physiology and nutrition and medicine, people think that because it's biochemistry, it has to be exact. But what they're not understanding is that we're still dealing with the body, and the body is still attached to the mind and the emotions. And so the body really is going to do what the mind and the emotions are, you know, so it's all from observation that we learn, just like you said, when you look at someone from a psychological perspective, you look at what is this individual showing about themselves that you can understand and formulate an understanding of that person in that moment. That's it. But if you extrapolate a theory out of what that person is showing and you try to apply that theory to every other human being simply because it's a human being that you're looking at, now you're getting into treacherous ground.
Well, now you're a drug company. Now you're one of the chemical companies like Pfizer that's selling chemicals and saying, aha, we can have depression all cured with this one pill because we got seven people who were depressed and now they're not depressed. Forget that they committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
They were depressed, now they weren't depressed. Now we can make a pill that applies to all people.
Well, it's even worse than that. They apply to rats, and because rat is a living thing with certain things that are similar to humans, they say, well, biochemistry is biochemistry.
And you know, Roberta, thank God for biochemistry.
Right.
Because they applied agents that would have killed, you know, we had no way of dealing with infection. And it was by applying it to rats that we found out, oh, we could come up with antibiotics. And an antibiotic, in some cases,
sure,
is the only thing
it's
you could do,
saver.
You know, a lifesaver. So thank God they have it. The problem is the one theory approach to life.
Right.
If you keep taking medication one after another, after another, after another, maybe you'll find a balance where if you take 74 pills, medications which many older people take, eventually you're going to feel okay. Well, it's the same thing with nutrition.
Yes.
Sometimes, Roberta, sometimes if somebody's taking like 14 pills, right? And they do, you know, they go up and
I tell them to stop. That's the first thing I say. I say, okay, stop. Just stop taking all that stuff. Stop. What do you think your stomach is? How is your stomach supposed to distinguish between 65 different amino acids and vitamins, and all in a concentrated form, in a dried up form, in a chemicalized form, when these are things that should come from food and should come with water, with fiber, with a bunch of other stuff? The stomach is not a laboratory. The stomach is not a biochemical toy set that you can just put a chemical in and you're going to get the same reaction every time, because the stomach is attached to your mind, your emotions, is attached to the part of you that cannot be controlled through biochemistry.
So we've been talking about the theory of no theory. And the idea here is simple, friends. It's not wrong. But remember, the average person who has a theory is selling a book.
Yeah.
And by that I mean they're saying to you, I got to pay the rent. So I gotta say, this way works all the time. I can say to you unequivocally that I believe the expression of emotion is better than the repression of emotion. But is that true all the time? No. But if I wanted to write a book on the expression of emotion and said this is what everybody has to do, people would buy my book because I'm a popular guy.
That's right.
And then I would have to say expression of emotion is good for everybody. No, my friend, sometimes I wish people would inhibit their emotions.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Learn not to breathe. Sometimes you just got to cool it, you know, when it's going over the edge. So we're going to take a little break. And after we take our break, when we come back, we're going to talk more about specific relationship between oxygen and breathing and the emotions from a relatively flexible theoretical point of view, which is what we're about. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, my friends, a little very special music to wake you up, and then we'll be right back with you.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas, heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
That's Katie. Melua. Katie Melua.
Katie Melua.
M-E-L-U-A. Oof.
You put a spell on me.
I put a spell on you. Is the name of the song. We're going to play more of that towards the end of the program. It's a long piece. It's exciting, though. Katie Melua.
It's nice.
Yeah. Hey, you know, Roberta, I was thinking about it. Everybody should get a... We need a new design for T-shirts. I have a design for T-shirts.
What is that?
How about a sign on everybody's chest that says, not for sale?
Mm, I like
Wouldn't that.
That
be a nice thing?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine being able to walk around and say to people, I'm not for sale.
Mm-hmm.
You can't buy me.
Mm-hmm.
Not for sale. The human condition. We are talking about two things. We're talking about an approach to understanding breathing, which is an introduction to our program tomorrow, where we're going to have one of the great pulmonary specialists on air talking about breath and all forms of physical disorders related to breathing. He's going to talk about everything from emphysema to asthma to sleep to having a cold. He wrote a book on what to do with colds.
Amazing. You could say that everything in the body is related to oxygen breathing. Every function, everything physiological that you can think of has something to do with oxygen intake.
Well, you know, and here are some of the things that we would see. If you learn early on what we said, this is Armand DeMille, Roberta Maria, on TWBAI 99.5 FM. If you learned really early on that you had to suppress your emotions and sensations, and you did it, one of the ways you did it is through tension and through breath holding. Now, almost everybody did it, you know what I mean? People learned that that's the way to do it. If you're crying and it's inappropriate to cry, you hold your breath.
Actually, no one has to teach you. It's instinctive. I mean, because imagine, let's say, when we were hominids and we were in a cave and all of a sudden at night you hear a noise and it could be a predator, it could be some enemy. What do? You hold your breath. You hold your breath. That's what you do automatically. Whenever you want to control yourself, you stop breathing.
Why don't you dial 911? You never know who you know.
They might not
they
have.
They may not have had it then.
Cell phones back then, or even landlines for that matter. I wonder if they had DSL.
But they did have air. They did have communication through the air. I can tell you, they probably had much more because they couldn't speak, so they had to communicate with each other some way. The idea is that you're right, Roberta. You have to be able to control and inhibit your emotions. Once you get that started, you learn to do that. Now, there are optimal breathing methods that we learn over time. You learn it when you exercise. When you do aerobic exercise, they teach you. Don't try not to breathe through your mouth. Breathe through your nose as much as possible. Try not to, you know, do pursed lip breathing if you could do it that way. And they teach you things. And we learn things over as we become adults, that there is a more efficient way of breathing even when you're speaking. You try to do it. You actually bring your attention to it. Now, I say that happens to you as you get older because as you get older, you have emotions to spare. You have sensations to spare because you've gone a little dead from holding it back so long.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're younger, you don't want to do this. When you're younger, you want to control yourself. Imagine being a horny 12-year-old, 13-year-old boy who can't control himself, right? And he is taught there is no way that you could express your sexuality in public. You got to control it. The guy just, you know, he practically screws himself into a knot to try to control it. There are so many times if somebody feels emotional and they want to cry, so many times they just absolutely control it. Some people convert emotions, like just look at how natural it is, convert sadness to anger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how efficient that
or
is.
Or anger to sadness.
But the sadness to anger is more important.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not more important, but an example of it is mm-hmm. you feel sad, you're crying. You don't want to cry. You tighten your body, and in that tension, the anger is so easily available.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now let's go the other way, the way you're saying. You're a kid and you're at home. And
anger to sadness.
Anger to sadness. The anger is not acceptable.
Right.
So what happens is you inhibit your anger. And instead of saying to someone, I'm angry at what you did because you couldn't get away with it, by holding your breath and contorting yourself, you start to cry.
Sure. So what we're saying is that breathing is the most, is the easiest way to control emotional expression and experience, and that we don't have to be told not to breathe in order not to feel. It's something that comes natural. Whenever we know that we're in a situation where we're not supposed to feel something, we tighten up and we reduce the intake of air. But that becomes it becomes a habit. Because in the long run, all of these emotions that we don't want to feel, well, it's not like they disappear. They simply go below the surface, so to speak, and they stay below the surface most of the time. And then if we open up our lungs and breathe, sometimes we have this wave of sadness or a wave of joy or a wave of anger. Why is it? Because all of a sudden we've sent oxygen to the cells that have been dormant and numbed out from lack of oxygen, and now the emotions that we've been suppressing are coming to the surface like a wave. And, you know, that's why Armand is saying maybe it's not always a good idea to breathe deeply. But there's another aspect that I would like to mention about oxygen, and that is that oxygen really is the one thing we need for extracting energy from food and for detoxifying from toxins. So whenever we decrease our oxygen intake or somehow limit the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide with the external world, what we're doing also is we're really manipulating our chemistry in every possible way imaginable, because we are controlling the pH of the blood and everything else. We're controlling the neurotransmitters, the hormones. We're controlling all the chemical messengers that determine how we feel and what we feel. They're all regulated by breathing.
So what we're talking about is how breathing, once what Roberta is saying, once you inhibit your breathing in service of your emotional well-being, there are going to be other things that happen in your body. Now, one thing, for example, of what happens in your body is simple. If you inhibit the oxygen supply, and again, we're saying that to control your emotions, well, believe it or not, amnesia and forgetfulness is directly related to the inhibition of oxygen. Now, let's say beyond a medical condition, a physical condition, which limits the oxygen going to your brain, I just want you to imagine as a child, you have very painful memories. Maybe there's some early sexual abuse or child abuse. What can a child do to deal with it? The pain of it is so bad, and yet you've been forbidden to tell anybody about it. You've been told, don't tell anybody, don't do anything. Well, do you understand a child can, through willfulness, inhibit the oxygen traveling to the brain and actually impair memory? That's why so many people I have seen who are either multiple personalities or dissociative personalities will say they forget. They don't remember their childhood. If you don't remember your childhood, it's highly possible that you purposely went to forget it.
And if you take in less oxygen, since oxygen is the gas that we use to extract energy from food, if you don't have enough oxygen in your system, you can't unlock that energy out of the nutrients that you're taking in. So many of the nutrients that come in through eating cannot be utilized because we don't have enough oxygen to oxidize them and release the energy. What happens then? Well, they can accumulate in the lymphatic system or somewhere else in the body in the form of toxins or waste. And that's another function of oxygen that is so important and not talked about, that, you know, when I talk about oxygen and weight loss, if you think that oxygen is what you use to burn glucose, to burn nutrients, well, if you don't have enough oxygen, how are you going to burn those nutrients? You're going to slow down your metabolism. And of course, anytime you deal with metabolism and nutrition and food intake and digestion, you're also dealing with your emotions.
Right. As you could tell, there's a tremendous amount of information about this. And again, tomorrow we're going to talk with make sure you tune in, Dr. Neil Schachter. But let's stick for a moment just with the emotions, just with the emotions. You can have, through different ways that you've adjusted your system, you can have an exaggerated startle response. You know, you've seen people who are edgy. And very often you're edgy because actually your oxygen isn't working. Your breathing isn't working, you know? You can be edgy for that. You can have chronic fatigue. Well, Roberta, of course it makes sense that a person who is, I've seen depressed people who have said, I have chronic fatigue. And it's hard to distinguish between chronic fatigue and depression because in both cases, the person's barely breathing.
Right. But the thing is that the solution is not to deepen the breath, because even though that seems like it would be the simple thing to do, if the person has been a shallow breather, there's a good reason.
That's
and that
it.
Needs to be understood and taken into account before we tell the person, well, just breathe more deeply. Because if through breathing more shallow, you keep at bay certain emotions and certain feelings that are unmanageable, well, you know, I mean, there needs to be some support and something has to come in before that negative load can be unlocked and dealt with.
And sometimes it's just the relationship you have with the practitioner that you're with, where you feel confident that if I unload this, I have somebody there who I could deal with it, you know, and that does a certain replacement, because most people who have inhibited their emotions, in effect, are orphans. You know, in effect, they didn't have a supportive parent around. So they inhibited their emotions, they held back their feelings, they swallowed their anger, they turned stuff against themselves, and then they get to be with somebody like Roberta, and who says, you know, okay, kiddies, now let's see what happens if we try to change this. Not, let's change it and that'll solve everything, because we're of the don't do it too quick school.
When I was doing this research, I looked, of course, on the internet for breathing and the emotions, breathing and mood, breathing and the mind. And everywhere on the internet, you'll find advice that tells you to breathe better, breathe more deeply, breathe through things, breathe this way, make sure you use this muscle, make sure you lift this finger, make sure you breathe through one nostril and then the other, make sure the nostrils are open. There's a lot of technical information and rules and do's and don'ts. And what I'm thinking is, well, basically, even just paying attention to the fact that I can breathe, that's reassuring enough to me. Just feeling my body breathing, being able to breathe, that's a great thing in itself. And it also accomplishes the task of bringing the mind back into the moment, back into the body. Maybe that's what all these practitioners really are trying to accomplish when they're giving all this advice. What they're doing is they're asking the person, bring your mind back here where your breath is, rather than allowing your mind to go to places where you get scared and you control your breathing because you're afraid of something that's not happened yet. Bring it into your body and just feel what it's like to breathe. Well, that alone, I think, relaxes the mind.
Well, it does in one level, you know, Roberta, and it could panic the mind also. It's what you're saying is, yes, it's a good idea. Here are some of the signs of people who inhibit their emotion, and inhibit their breathings. The following signs, if you were to see them, if you were to see panic attacks, anxiety, phobias, nightmares and night terrors, mental blankness and spaciness, intrusive flashbacks, inability to make commitments, inability to bond with other individuals, thyroid dysfunction, believe it or not, hyperactivity, hyperarousal, anhedonia. Now, anhedonia is an interesting thing when you think about it. It means the inability to experience pleasure, something that happens a lot to people who are depressed. In order to experience pleasure, you've got to be able to send oxygen to certain parts of your body. But you know, sometimes you don't want to experience pleasure. Sometimes it makes you yearn too much. Sometimes it makes you hurt too much. Sometimes it reminds you too much of the past. You become anhedonic, and that happens with very depressed people. Think about it. I mean, they want to just lay there, and they're just trying to get through. Reminds me of the hospital. You go to a person goes into surgery, and they go into surgery, and the two things that everybody wants you to do is they want you to move around right away. Now, this is not just because managed care no longer pays for hospital stay, but they say get you out of there as fast as possible. But the things that the doctors are most concerned about, the three things are they're concerned about bed sores, which means you should move around so you don't get these bed sores. Number two, move your legs so you don't get blood clots in your legs. And number three, breathe. Make an effort to breathe. So they have you sit up. Sometimes they give you a spirometer after surgery, and they tell you, take a deep breath and try to keep this ball in the air. That's because the body, when it senses pain, wants to inhibit breathing to so shallow, so small, that there's barely anything taking place, because when you're in a bed and you're sick and you've just been through surgery and you've had narcotics, you don't want to feel anything. So you breathe so shallowly.
So basically, Armand, what you're saying is that the less you breathe, the more numb you become.
Exactly.
Which makes sense from a physiological standpoint, because with oxygen you extract nutrients from food, as I said before, and you also offset toxicity, you detoxify yourself. So the less you breathe, the less energy you're extracting from food, and the less toxins you are eliminating. And a lot, and so if you think about, people extract energy using oxygen, but when there's not enough oxygen, some of this energy is extracted not through oxidation, but through fermentation, for instance, in the digestive system. Well, you know what that does, Armand? It increases ethanol in the blood. It increases alcohol in the system. And so if people, for instance, feel depressed or upset or panicky or any kind of mood or emotional upset, it could also be that through this fermentation there are toxins that are affecting the brain in such a way that it develops those disorders.
We're going to have to do a whole program just on fermentation, you know, because we've got just a couple of minutes left. What we're talking about is what happens to you when it has it, you know. But just talking about the hospital bed for a minute again, Roberta, one of the things you said is very important. Although the body demands that you breathe shallow, you do not detoxify. And when you're in a hospital, you generally have taken on so many chemicals. They've given you painkillers that have stopped your body from, in effect, moving. So, in effect, you know, they want to get you breathing so that you can detoxify. But that's what the hospital nurses and doctors do. They want to get you moving. because they want you to get the stuff out of your system. Because if you just lay there and you keep breathing that shallow, shallow breath that your mind is telling you to do based on a belief that you're wounded, that you just have to stay there and breathe for a shallow period of time and maybe you'll recover, well, we know that that's not going to be best for you in helping some of this junk get past your body, some of the stuff they give you. So it's very difficult, you know. It's very difficult because the body will tell you to do things that will in some way inhibit your well-being. Headaches, psychosomatic illnesses, asthma, digestive, spastic colon, premenstrual syndrome, all seem to be related to the inhibition of emotion through the inhibition of oxygen. Now, tomorrow, through breathing, tomorrow what we're going to have on the air is a doctor who's going to tell us about all of the disorders that happen to people. That what is it like and what happens to you and what physically happens to you. So be sure to tune in. I haven't seen a program like this in a very long time. I haven't seen somebody come in and say, let's talk about your lungs and how they function. It is not going to be as psychological as it's going to be a straight physical description from a man who seems to be very wise. And Roberta, of course, is going to be on her way to, isn't it time for you to go to Italy?
I'm leaving tomorrow.
You're leaving tomorrow and you'll be back in a few days?
I'll be back in time to start my program at the Open Center.
You're going
to
be doing a teaching program at the Open Center, which people can get in touch with. So this is the beginning of it, my friends. Emotions and feelings, they go together, but it doesn't mean that the way you do it is just jump into hyperventilating and you're suddenly going to have all kinds of mental health.
So what are we saying today, Armand? We're saying that theories don't always apply, and we're saying that breathing follows the emotions, and it goes hand in hand with emotional experience and expression, and that through breath we can get to understand ourselves better.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment and summary of what we said today?
I like it very much.
Great.
Thank you, Roberta Atti. If you want to get in touch with Roberta Atti, you can go to her website.
CreativeHealthSolutions.org.
Or you can go to Armand DeMille at thepositivemind.com, where, of course, you can webcast, typecast. You can do all kinds of casting. You could fly fish. No, you can go to, you can get actually podcasting now from iTunes. You go to podcasting, you go to higher education, which they consider us to be, and you'll find the Positive Mind up there as well. So then you can even mail the program to a friend of yours. Here, as promised, Katie Malua's going to go back and complete this I Put a Spell on You. Kind of amazing. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Roberta Maria Atti, thank you once again.
Thank you, Armand.